Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jeremy Scahill.
Well, I padded the audience tonight because I have basically like 50 members of my family over here. You know, my dad and I apparently are on the same life pattern. I went out right before I came up here to go to the bathroom. My dad, of course, was out there waiting to use the bathroom, and he said, you know, puts his arm around me, and I'm thinking he's going to say some deep thing to me about speaking in front of a fairly large audience, and he says, tell him that you're happy to be in a Catholic school gym with glass backboards. We grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and we went to a small Catholic grade school called St. Rose of Lima, and we had a gym that certainly did not look like this. We used to go and play in gyms that looked like this, and we would always say, wow, those white people have a lot of money, because it was primarily a black and Puerto Rican neighborhood, and we had never seen glass backboards until we would go to the sort of more well-funded white schools. So just to give you context, and my dad also was the basketball coach at that school. I also found it very heartening that the very first person that I spoke to when I walked in here used the phrase goddamn within 5 seconds of saying hello to me. I'll try not to swear in the church tonight. I know we have some diehard Catholics here. I'm really honored to be here honoring Chicago area Peace Action. I was with you all some years ago when the Blackwater book first came out, and my researcher on that book, who his mother was a member of your coalition, she passed away, her name was Elaine Ordower, was also a close friend of Nancy Cusack, who's not with us tonight. And you know, I had a sort of bizarre, how I got here was sort of a bizarre way. I mean, got here tonight, not that my parents did anything weird that resulted in me being born, but I got a call from John Cusack, who of course is a fantastic actor, and from my generation, any girlfriend I ever had in high school would say, why aren't you more like John Cusack? But I got a call from John saying, you know, my mom wants you to come and speak to her peace group. What I thought it was going to be was sort of that Elaine had gotten together a sort of book club or something. And so I said, of course, you know, of course I'll do that. And next thing I know, I'm coming here to meet all of you wonderful people. And I want to take a pause for a moment before I get into the meat of what I'm going to say tonight to just thank each and every one of you for the action that you're taking in the name of peace and for the work that you do, and to encourage people who are visiting, including my family, many of whom live around here but are not members of Kappa, to join this organization. Because we are now at a moment where we have a Democratic president, who of course is from Chicago, despite what the Tea Party thinks. He is very popular with many people in the base, and many of his policies I agree with or I have no problem with, but that's a boring conversation. Is he better than Republicans would be is a boring conversation to me. What is the real conversation that we should be having as people who believe in peace and justice, and both in our local communities but also internationally, is if the Democrats are asking for your support, what do you have a right to ask in return? You have a right in return to say, when you say you're going to close Guantanamo, that you're going to close Guantanamo. We have a right to say that when you say you're going to reset our relationship with the Muslim world, that you're actually going to do it, that you're not going to start new drone wars in other countries. That when you say that you're going to stop the war against immigrants, you are not going to deport record numbers of people when you actually get into power. See, at the end of the day, and I know that we have some people here that are Democratic Party officials, and the fact that they're here tonight means that, of course, they're doing excellent work. In fact, one of them went to high school with my dad, so I hope I don't get in trouble here. But I actually am against the two-party system in this country because I don't think it serves the broader interests of people that are about justice. It doesn't mean that I don't think there are great people running as Democrats for office. Of course there are. I know some of them. I have problems with her, but in general, I really think she's done a good job in Washington. I like Jan Schakowsky. I think Jan Schakowsky has done a great job on the Intelligence Committee. She asks questions that no other members of Congress ask there. When Blackwater was first coming to prominence after the massacre at Nisar Square in 2007, Jan Schakowsky was the single most aggressive member of Congress in trying to go after them and the mercenary industry as a whole. I disagree with Jan on some of her policies, but I bring her up as an example to say that there are people who run as Democrats and serve as Democrats. Dennis Kucinich never left the Democratic Party, and he was a great member of Congress. But the point here isn't to bash the Democrats. The point here is that there was a coup in this country long ago that didn't require generals or guns or weapons. It was a silent coup. And the coup d'etat was when corporations took control of our electoral process. Nothing will fundamentally change in our society. Nothing. No, I don't care what issue it is that you work on. Nothing will fundamentally change in this society until we get big corporations out of our electoral process. I want to see a member of Congress, and I don't care if it's a Democrat or a Republican or a carnival crazy Tea Party member, I want to see somebody put forward a bill that members of Congress should be required to wear a uniform when they go into the Capitol. And that uniform should look like a NASCAR outfit where they have to wear their sponsors' logos on their uniform when they go into Congress every day. I became a journalist by accident. I actually wanted to be a teacher when I was growing up. And when I graduated from high school, I thought that what I wanted to do was to teach in an economically disadvantaged or targeted area. But I had a little bit of a stumble in the first quarter of my time at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is that the kid who wanted to be a teacher was an atrocious student. And I was put on academic probation the moment that I set foot on that campus. I continued to just, stumble through college. I wasn't out partying and acting stupid. I wasn't a screw up. I wasn't doing drugs. Well, I wasn't doing drugs a lot, but I wasn't really. my brother's here tonight and could really spill the beans on me in front of my parents, so I don't want that to happen. But I was engaged politically. I was a voracious reader. I was very interested in politics. I was just bad at school. And after 2.5 years of really failing and on the verge of being kicked out of the university system in Wisconsin, I decided that I wanted to work with people who were homeless. I had been engaged in a political struggle on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Madison and over the rights of homeless people on the campus. The administration there, which was an increasingly corporatized administration in the 1990s, at what is remembered as a very left-wing school. Forget that history. It's been a corporate takeover of public education in a lot of cities and states in this country. And I learned from this struggle of fighting against a corporatized administration of a public university that direct action, that actually doing activism and not just the academic theory of activism, was what was important. And so I remember sitting down with my parents and saying, I'm going to leave school. And these people that I know are driving out to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to hitch a ride with them, and I'm going to move into a homeless shelter, the nation's largest homeless shelter. And I really thought that my parents were going to have a heart attack. And I remember both of them being incredibly supportive because they knew that I wasn't in a position where I was happy or where I actually was learning much of anything. And both of my parents are nurses who care deeply about the world, and they didn't raise us to be radicals as kids. They raised us to be concerned about the world around us, and they did it through an example of how they cared about the people around them. But I did grow up in a household where the autobiography of Malcolm X was around, where the writings of Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker movement, were around. In fact, my dad had lived at the Catholic Worker for a couple of years in the early 1970s and went down to Cuba on the Venceremos Brigade, but I didn't grow up in an activist household per se. So there's some quote on, I've only looked at it twice, I think, the Wikipedia page on me, where it's like, I grew up in a family of social justice activists. I mean, that's true in a sense, but they weren't activists in the sense that whatever right-winger put that up there to try to make it seem like I'm not a real journalist thinks. I grew up in a household, and I've met so many people here tonight who also are teachers or social workers or engaged in the world. I grew up in a house where my parents were actually about something on the micro level. in their real lives. And and when I started to get interested in international affairs, in the politics of race in America, it was the experience of growing up with people that cared about the people around them that shaped me to be able to think about what can I do to make an impact internationally or on a local level with people who are homeless. So I decided I wanted to do this, and my parents were totally supportive. And I remember my dad, we were sitting on our front porch, and my dad said to me a couple of days before I left, you know, when you go out there, I just want one thing to be clear. Do not let school get in the way of your education. And it to me, it was like one of the best days of my life because I thought they were going to kill me. And instead, they kind of embraced this. So I go out to D.C. I lived in this mess of a huge homeless shelter called the Community for Creative Nonviolence. It was the nation's largest homeless shelter, just a couple of blocks from the U.S. Capitol. In fact, it was created by activists during the Reagan administration who took over an abandoned building quite near the U.S. Capitol, not far from the White House. And they occupied this space and created it as a place where people from the streets could come and live and work and also engage in political discussion. And they would do direct actions, like they released a whole pack of rats onto the White House lawn. And some of the rats then were found like in Nancy Reagan's swimming pool and other things. And it was a whole, you know, now, I mean, there's this whole thing about people jumping the White House lawn, you know. We're chasing deranged people on the White House lawn. At this point, they had to try to get the rats off of it because they were being released by activists who were advocating on behalf of low-income tenants and homeless people. But by the time I had arrived there, it was sort of a shell of its former self. The activist stuff wasn't there, and that's part of what I was looking for. It was a very large homeless shelter, and it was in 1995, the summer of 95. And it was the 50th anniversary of the United States atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the entire peace movement had come to Washington, D.C. To commemorate the nuclear bombing of Japan. And I met all of these incredible people. And one of the days during the sustained couple of weeks of protests, I had gotten to know people from the Community Jonah House, which was founded and run by Philip Berrigan, who I'm sure many people in this room know of Philip and Daniel Berrigan, the leaders of the Catonsville Nine, which was the most famous action of the Vietnam War against the draft, where they went into a draft house in Catonsville, Maryland, outside of Baltimore, and there were nine of them, and they dressed in their, Phil Berrigan used to call it the monkey suit, they were dressed in their priest outfits, and they... my dad can tell me the exact term for those kinds of that kind of garb, I forget. But they went in and they took all of these A1 draft files, the draft files that were being used to send in this particular draft house, primarily poor African Americans to the front lines to kill and die in the war in Vietnam. And they took all of these hundreds of draft files in broad daylight in front of the clerks in this local government office. And they put them into metal trash bins, and they took them into the parking lot in Catonsville, Maryland, and they dumped them all in a pile, and then they burned them with homemade napalm that they had manufactured after the U.S. Army manual had been leaked. And so they created their own napalm, and they burned these A1 draft files, and it was caught on video. And Daniel Berrigan, the great Jesuit poet priest, who still is alive and is approaching his 100th birthday, wrote a statement on behalf of the Catonsville Nine, and the opening line of it was, "Our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children." It's a devastating line if you think about it. And my dad was politicized as a young Catholic who grew up in a theologically conservative Irish Catholic family and was in the seminary himself. And he was changed by people like Thomas Merton and Daniel Berrigan and Philip Berrigan and the great Episcopalian theologian William Stringfellow. And it forever altered the course of his life, and that it had an impact on us as kids. So the reason, just to bring it back to the story I was telling you, that in 1995 I knew who the Berrigans were was because of the house that I grew up in. And so I was at a big demonstration one day, and I had just met Daniel Berrigan, and I was talking to his sister-in-law, Liz McAllister, who was also an incredible activist in her own right and remains a great activist. And she says to me, this kid that she had just met, would you mind taking, we're outside the Pentagon at a demonstration, would you mind taking Daniel to go and use the bathroom in the Pentagon? So I'm going to take Daniel Berrigan to go take a piss inside the Pentagon. So we go into the Pentagon, and a couple of Pentagon employees recognize him and say, "Oh, Father Berrigan, I remember when you threw blood on the Pentagon." But we access before 9/11. You could just kind of walk into the Pentagon. Now you can't get anywhere near it, especially not if you're with Dan Berrigan. But we go into the Pentagon, and I'm standing at a urinal in the Pentagon, and there's a guy in uniform. There's Dan Berrigan, and there's me standing at the urinals. And Dan Berrigan's kind of humming, and he goes, "You know, when this place was built, they said that after the war was over, they were going to turn it into the world's largest hospital." And he said, "You know, and what's amazing is that they told the truth. It's the largest insane asylum in the world." So I ended up meeting the Berrigans, and then Phil Berrigan asked me to come and help them build this house that they were building on this old Catholic cemetery in Baltimore, and the church at that time was divesting a lot of its properties, and still to this day, one of the largest land transfers in the history of the United States is happening right now, which is the Catholic Church moving all of its properties into the private sector in many cases. And it's very controversial because the church, if they're just selling it to hedge funds or real estate developers, that goes against the grain probably of what a lot of, particularly the Jesuits, the Franciscans, other orders wanted. But it's a huge sort of scandal. But what had happened in Baltimore is that the Berrigans had convinced the archdiocese to transfer what was a very large plot of land of the Catholic Church over to this radical group of anti-war activists. The only stipulation was that they had to take care of the cemetery. So they built a house on a cemetery, and they still caretake the cemetery, and Philip Berrigan is buried on that cemetery. So I went out there to help them build that house. And what I did every day pretty much for a year while that house was being built is that Phil and I, and Phil Berrigan had spent, one-seventh of his life in prison doing anti-war actions. And he was a World War II decorated combat veteran, a radical civil rights priest, was an amazing guy. But I spent pretty much every day of my life for a year painting houses with Phil Berrigan. We were making money off the books, no federal taxes, anti-war tax resistors, painting houses to make money to support the project of building this community that would sort of be a hub in the Washington, D.C. area, the belly of the beast, for anti-war organizing. And on ladders and sitting on coolers over lunch, I got a totally alternative political education about the history of the United States. And I realized that what I really wanted to do was something in journalism. I wanted to write about the way that the world was. It's just that I had never really been out of Wisconsin before. You know, I didn't grow up in a family that would vacation anywhere requiring an airplane. We would go to Six Flags one day and the Wisconsin Dells for 2 days, and we called it a summer vacation. So I didn't know really much at all about the world. And I remember that Phil was a big fan of this journalist named Amy Goodman. And they would listen to her while they were painting houses and everything. And so I was still doing some volunteering at the homeless shelter. I was at Jonah House, and we're painting houses. And we would listen to this woman every day. And to me, it was like this incredible revelation. I had never heard any journalist speak the way that she spoke. I'll never forget when Newt Gingrich became the Speaker of the House. And for the younger people here, just think of a lizard that somehow gets elected to Congress, and there you have Newt Gingrich. And his name is very appropriate. But the Republicans in the mid-1990s got a lot of money with the rise of the radical religious right. They had a lot of corporate money, and they orchestrated a campaign to take control of the Congress under the auspices of something called the Contract with America. And Newt Gingrich became the Speaker of the House. And he's an absolutely brilliant person, and I'm not saying that as a compliment to him in any way politically, but he is a very savvy guy politically. And he's also a very reprehensible person on a moral level. But he was a good orator, he was a very effective salesman, and they won. And they win, and then they proceed to implement an agenda that was against the poor, was against women, was for war, was for the Pentagon. It was basically everything you support in this room, they were against. Everything that you are for, everything that you're against in this room, they were for, is the shortest way to explain, because I assume in general here people are social justice. So Newt Gingrich decides that he basically is like the emperor of Washington, and he's going to implement a tradition where the Speaker of the House holds a daily press briefing to brief the American people on the crimes of Bill Clinton. And at that time, you know, it was on C-SPAN, and there wasn't like cable news in the way that we understand it now. And I mean, C-SPAN always has sort of been the place to go to fall asleep. You know, if you want to watch, if you need a good nap, just watch C-SPAN for a couple of hours on a Saturday afternoon. But Gingrich would hold his daily press briefings, and C-SPAN would air them. And it was just like a propaganda fest. Well, this journalist, Amy Goodman, goes there during a time, and I'm sure people remember this, this period, where a controversy had taken place because at the time, a very famous journalist named Connie Chung had done an interview with Newt Gingrich's mother. And she said to Newt Gingrich's mother, "What does Newt think about First Lady Hillary Clinton?" And she said, "Oh, not very much." And Connie Chung said, "Well, has he said anything specific about Hillary Clinton?" And she says, "Yes, but I don't think I should say it on television." And then Connie Chung, meanwhile, this is like being watched by like 100 million people. Connie Chung leans in, "You can tell me." and she says, "Well, he called her a name that rhymes with witch." So at the next Newt Gingrich press briefing, Amy Goodman goes to that press briefing, this great journalist who now hosts a show called Democracy Now. And she does something incredibly smart, which is at the time there was only one camera in the room. And it's a camera that was just focused on Newt Gingrich. And so if a journalist asked a question, they would have to pan the camera over to them. But she went and stood right next to the camera so that it wouldn't be able to pan anywhere except stay on old Newt Gingrich. And she gets up and says, "Speaker Gingrich, through your policies, you have set a tone that is anti-women in this country with the contract with America. And I wanted to ask you when you are going to apologize to American women for calling First Lady Hillary Clinton a bitch." And Gingrich is just like, and he says, "I didn't say what you said I said." And she said, "So are you calling your mother a liar?" And it sort of went downhill from there. And then the headline, though, in the Washington Post the next day was, "Gingrich can't ditch bitch comment." He then canceled his daily speaker's press briefing and never did another one because of Amy Goodman. So I started writing, for younger people in the room, I'm going to use some terms you probably don't recognize, but I started writing letters to Amy Goodman, asking her if I could volunteer with her. And I had this image in my head that she had like 500 people working for her because they were reporting on the rebels' efforts to overthrow Mobutu Sese Seko in Congo and immigrant rights movements and airing commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and they seemed to be at every activist organizing thing, and it was sort of incredible. And she never responded. And eventually I met Amy Goodman at an exhibit that I was helping to curate at the Catholic Worker in New York about the life of Dorothy Day. And I basically said, you know, that I'm not going to leave you alone. I really want to volunteer for you. And the short of the story is that she had to decide whether to let me volunteer or to get an actual restraining order against me. And luckily, she let me volunteer, and I've worked in journalism ever since. And I don't think that it should be a prerequisite to be a journalist to have a college degree or to have studied it as a course of academic pursuit. I think that some of the best journalists in our society are the people for whom journalism burns fierce in their heart, young people who dare to take a chance and bet on themselves, who are willing to get dirt under their fingernails by going out and trying to tell the stories that no one else will tell. When high school students come up to me and ask me, they say, "I want to do what you do," I tell them right off the bat that I was technically enrolled at a university, but I never really went to college, and I don't tell people not to go to college, but I don't think that that's a prerequisite to define you as a member of society who's trying to contribute something, particularly on justice. And in some cases, our educational model is totally outdated. It doesn't speak to a lot of young people. There are a lot of young people who are about something, and an old model doesn't apply to the way that their brain works, to the way that they've experienced life. We need, as a society, to think about different ways of approaching educating young people, particularly if they want to serve humanity. There should be apprenticeships, not just internship where you're getting coffee for people, but apprenticeships where people can study under other journalists the way that you learn a trade, like being a carpenter or a plumber or an electrician. That would be the best way we could train the next generation of journalists who are about something, is by actually putting them into the field right away with people that are already doing what they want to do. I believe in young people in this country. I spend a lot of time around them, and I don't think that universities in the way that we have them structured right now are serving young people. And I'm not saying that as a matter of theory. I'm saying because I learned it firsthand, because university didn't fit for me, but boy, did I have an incredible political education, and I got it because I was lucky enough for someone like Amy Goodman to say, I'll give you a chance, and you show me what you can do, and if what you're doing makes sense to what we want to do, you can stick around. And that's what I did. And I wasn't thinking about money. I wasn't thinking about fame. I was thinking about, my God, this is the most exciting thing I've ever done in my life, and I feel like I actually might be able to make a change in the world. And that's why I always try to work with young people. And I ended up with a crazy set of experiences where I went to Nigeria and Iraq and Yugoslavia and Yemen and all over the world. And I never viewed myself as some highfalutin journalist. I never viewed myself as someone that would ever be invited on television. What I thought was that I was given a gift, and it was a gift of access to people that the world had never heard of. And they were unfamous people. And they were people that lived on the other side of America's bombs or on the other side of our foreign policy. And I had this great, I've always hated power, but I had a great reverence for the victims of American power. And I felt honored to meet people in Fallujah and Basra and in the niche marketplace in Belgrade after it had been hit with cluster bombs. And I always approached the families of people who were killed or to approach people who were wounded as though I was meeting an honored person. And why is that? It seems like maybe it's a twisted thinking about it, but it's because I felt like I was given the gift of access to someone who actually could explain something about the state of power in the country that I came from, that we're never allowed to access. When we talk about ISIS today, and we look at the crisis, and we talk about Syria, and we look at now the sort of new old new war in Iraq, and what's going to happen in Syria, we hear all sorts of chatter from the elite classes. And this think tank has their person pontificating, and that think tank has their person pontificating. But when was the last time that you actually heard from someone that wasn't paid by some entity in Washington to discuss what they want to happen in their country? An ordinary person. I'm not talking about highly educated think tankers. I'm talking about ordinary people in Iran, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in any of these countries. When a young Yemeni man named Farai al-Muslimi came to the United States to testify in front of Congress. He came 2 weeks after his family's village was hit in a U.S. drone strike, and 11 members of his family were killed. And only two members of Congress came to hear him testify. Two, your congressperson was not there. Two members of Congress came to hear a Yemeni who had 11 members of his family killed in a U.S. drone strike. He's a university student who spoke fluent English, gave incredibly articulate testimony, and only two members of the U.S. Congress bothered to show up. You wonder how the United States keeps repeating its mistakes over and over and over again. We don't listen to anybody that knows anything about anything in these war zones. We keep recycling the same discredited quote-unquote experts. How is it that neocons like Bill Kristol show up on the Sunday talk shows? How is it that people that got us into the war in Iraq with their lies and their propaganda are somehow accepted as legitimate members of our society who have any business being on television instead of prison? You can tell a lot in our country right now about which former U.S. officials are on book tour and which whistleblowers are in jail. Right now, Leon Panetta is on a book tour. Donald Rumsfeld is on a book tour. Jose Rodriguez, who was the chief architect of the CIA's torture program and their black sites program, he's on a book tour. But John Kiriakou, CIA officer who blew the whistle on waterboarding, is doing a federal prison sentence. Chelsea Manning is doing 35 years in prison right now for releasing the WikiLeaks cables. Edward Snowden is in exile right now. Thomas Drake, the NSA whistleblower that Mike mentioned earlier, is working at an Apple store in Virginia after having had a 29-year career at the NSA and the Air Force. And he didn't leak documents to anyone. He did what they said Snowden should have done. He went up the chain of command, and then they went after him, and they raided his home. Same like they did with Bill Binney before him, who blew the whistle on the largest domestic collection effort against American citizens in the NSA's history. They raided his home while he was in the shower at gunpoint. So when people say, oh, Snowden should have just told people up his chain of command, he read about what they did to people that did that and realized that that wasn't an answer. We are at a moment right now where it has never, ever been more dangerous for journalists in the world. In Mexico, journalists are gunned down for reporting on narco cartels. They're gunned down by right-wing death squads, and they're gunned down by paramilitary groups that are allied with the Mexican government. In Somalia, journalists are being killed in record numbers. In Syria, the overwhelming majority of journalists who are having their heads cut off and are being kidnapped and executed, we never hear about on the news because they're not white Americans. And lest you think I'm being insensitive to the Americans that have been killed, I knew James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, the two American journalists who were beheaded. In fact, my dad went to James Foley's memorial at Marquette University. James Foley and I share a birthday. When I watched James Foley's, and I did, I watched James Foley's execution video and saw him there in his orange jumpsuit. And the thing that struck me about it was how calm James Foley was when he delivered his statement. And there's a lot of theories as to why that happened, but I believe that what ISIS is doing when they are taking these Americans or Brits and executing them is that they put them through a torture program that they learned from us, where they are telling these guys that they're going to kill them. And they bring them to the point where it looks like they're going to have their heads cut off, and then they force them to read a sentence or read a statement. And then they do it again the next day and the next day, to the point where these guys have no idea what day they're going to die. And so maybe they took take 31 of James Foley's execution out of 40. Maybe they decided take 29 was better. But they broke them to the point where they didn't even think about what was happening anymore, because it was happening every day. The CIA does this to prisoners too. CIA tells people, we've just murdered your family. They do it to try to break you down. James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, before they were beheaded, had been waterboarded repeatedly. They were held in the orange jumpsuits. They were put into small boxes. Why do you think ISIS is doing this to them? Do you think ISIS just invented these torture tactics? No. They read about it because that's what the CIA did. That's what the CIA was doing in black sites around the world with our tax dollars and in our name. And the man who orchestrated that program for the CIA is on a book tour right now. And his bosses are on book tours right now. And so when we look at what's happening right now, and there's all this discussion of the savagery and who would behead someone like that. Yes, it does look savage. And I agree it is savage to cut off someone's head in that manner. But if you stop your analysis at the micro level and say that specific act was an act of savagery, without understanding everything else that led up to it, you're not engaged in an intellectually honest discussion about what America's role in the world is today. You just want to play into something that says Muslims are the kind of people that do this kind of thing. Well, are Muslims the kind of people that take people and send them to an island and spray them with chemical agents and put them out in the sun to be sunburned and tie them up and put them in a box with a caterpillar and tell them it's a tarantula and leave them in there for 3 days with some furry thing crawling on them? These are things America did too. So if we're going to condemn ISIS, and I think we should, for the tactics that we can prove and that we've seen happen, we better also be willing to look in our own backyard and say, what is our role in doing the exact same kinds of things? We have ceased to have an honest discussion in this country about who we have become in the world. It's boring to talk about Bush and Cheney. I could tell you a million stories about their criminality. They were Murder Incorporated. Many of them belong in jail. People ask me, what do you think about Syria? I say, I think Bashar al-Assad is a war criminal, and he should go to The Hague, but not unless Donald Rumsfeld has the cell next to him. Because there's no point in talking about international law unless American personnel, officials, soldiers are subjected to the same standards as other nations around the world. And yet we claim to have this moral authority. And a lot of liberals say, oh, we need to intervene in this conflict. We need to do the airstrikes against ISIS. I think a lot of people of genuinely goodwill are advocating policies that have a military aim. And I don't think they're doing it because they want Boeing and Lockheed Martin to make the profit. I think they're doing it because they're motivated by a sense of humanity, and they're saying, what do we do to stop this slaughter? But inviting the United States to take a military action in a region that we have systematically destroyed for the last several decades, you could go all the way back and say that when the U.S. was on the side of overthrowing Mossadegh in Iran, which was largely a CIA plot, and supporting the rise of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the United States has had a consistent foreign policy in that region. It's been consistently against the civilians of those countries and against any semblance of a democratic process. So if you want to talk to me about how the U.S. should be doing airstrikes in Kobani, or we have to help this suffering group of people somewhere else, I want you to tell me how that reconciles with 50-plus years of history that has shown that we never intervene for purely humanitarian reasons. We will intervene when it's on our side. You want to look at what American foreign policy is? Study what happened to the Kurds. The Kurds are the largest group of stateless individuals in the world, similar to the Palestinians in terms of how they've been treated by history, except that the Kurds have been surrounded by enemies from every single country where they live, whether it's Iran or Syria or Iraq or Turkey. And the United States, in 1994, when they were saying we need to stop Slobodan Milosevic, we need to go into Yugoslavia, we need to stop the genocide, was the number one provider of weapons to the Turkish government that were being used to systematically murder Kurds. So if you want to talk about how the U.S. is on the side of the Kurds now, reconcile that with the fact that the U.S. was supporting the weapons that were going to commit genocide against the Kurds. It's not that nothing should be done. It's that U.S. militarism is not the answer to the problem. And we have played such a bad role in that region. We have played such a bad role in that region that the well is poisoned. It's toxic. And I believe, and I'm not saying this just from the comfort of a couch somewhere, I'm saying it from having traveled to many of these countries, having spoken with people who are active members of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, the Taliban in Afghanistan. I have come to believe that the chief motivating factor for many of these groups right now in the world, their number one recruitment tool is American foreign policy. And if that's true, I don't care whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, if you just simply boil this down and say, what is the end result of our foreign policy when it comes to counterterrorism right now? The end result is that we're killing a tremendous number of innocent people. We're encouraging a new generation of young Muslims to believe that we are a gratuitous enemy, that we actually are at war against their religion, but we also are jeopardizing our own national security by giving motivation to so-called lone wolf terrorists and to militant organizations around the world who do actually subscribe to a warped, corrupted interpretation of their religion, just like George W. Bush subscribed to a warped interpretation of his religion. And until we take a sober look at our foreign policy, until we step back and sort of say, look, unless we really hit the reset button, unless we say we're going to pull out from drone bombing all these countries, we're going to stop sending in covert forces, we're going to put the onus on those who claim that America is the great evil in the world to prove it. Unless we do that and take the moral high ground, we are doomed to have other terrorist attacks in this country. We are doomed to create a world where we have more enemies than we do friends. Some people may object to me saying we when talking about the United States, but if I didn't believe that through action we could change this, then I wouldn't live here anymore. I actually would leave. But I don't consider myself a patriot in the way that the Fox News people want you to wear a big flag. and I hate patriotism. I'm an anti-nationalism, but I believe in the genuine goodness of people. And it's because of a room of people like this that I actually think it's a battle worth fighting. That people do care, that they take time out of their busy lives as social workers or teachers or doctors or nurses to come to something like this. You could be off watching the movies tonight, but why are you here? You're here because you want to be with like-minded people and say, what the f*** do we do in such a dark time that we live in? Yeah. And I want to leave a little bit of time for question and answer, but just quickly, I want to say that recently, 4 Blackwater operatives were convicted in connection with the single largest massacre of Iraqi civilians that we know of private contractors, and one of them went down on a murder charge. The other 3 went down on voluntary manslaughter charges, and then a 5th guard pled guilty to a lesser charge to testify against his colleagues. Without getting into too many details, this was an incredibly significant victory for the victims' families of this. Just to remind people, 17 Iraqi civilians gunned down in a crowded Baghdad intersection on September 16, 2007. I believe those guys all should have gone down for murder, not just voluntary manslaughter. And I followed the case very closely and talked with a lot of lawyers about it, including the investigators for the U.S. military who responded right after it, one of whom is a military lawyer. But the fact is that the founder of that company, Eric Prince, who's a multi-millionaire, made a killing off of the killing, he's walking around as a free man, and no irony, he is also on book tour. He walks around a free man. The senior officials from the Bush administration and the Obama administration who deployed those unaccountable forces walk around as free men. Until we as a society are willing to hold our own public officials to the same standard that we expect of the Milosevic's of the world, then we don't have any place saying we're the shining city on the top of the hill, that our democracy is the one that should be studied, because at the end of the day, we're saying that there's one standard for certain countries around the world, and there's another standard for us, even if we commit the very same crimes. It's the reason why I think the corporations need to be out of our electoral process. It's the reason why I think that people like Rumsfeld shouldn't just be sort of the subject of scorn among the left or liberals or others, but should actually be in a judicial process right now where he's fighting for his very liberty. Until we transform our society into a model where we hold our public officials accountable, then nothing's going to fundamentally change. And the thing is, if corporations are people, according to the Supreme Court, if corporations are people, then we should have a death penalty for corporations that commit grave crimes. In closing, I want to tell you a story, and Rosalie Regal is here, who is a great historian of the Catholic worker movement, so she'll certainly know this story, but a lot of people in this room probably have a shared experience, which is you're at a demonstration, and there's a handful of people out there, and you're getting people honking the horn at you to support you, and then you'll get the people that come to heckle you, but you don't have some mass of people. It's not a million-person march on the federal building or the local post office on tax day or something. There's a handful of you who have sort of dared to say no in a time of universal yes, and it can get very deflating and depressing to come out there and see that the hair is only getting grayer and younger people aren't coming, or that your numbers aren't swelling, they're maybe shrinking. But I always remember this story that this old anarchist who was a major person within the Catholic worker movement in the very early days, Ammon Hennessy, who was an anarchist and a World War I draft resister, and Ammon Hennessy and others would organize protests outside of the White House during a period when no one was really demonstrating in any capacity outside of some partisan cause, and they're protesting against the American wars at a very unpopular time to do so. And a newsman came up to Ammon Hennessy and said to him, Mr. Hennessy, you're not gonna, I don't know why you're here today, because you're not gonna change their minds, referring to the people inside the White House. And he said, that may be true, but they sure as hell aren't gonna change mine. And I often think about what is the connection between efficacy and morality, and what does it mean as a human being to grapple with that? And I think somewhere there's a balance between the kind of audacious embrace of no in a time of the comfortable universal embrace of yes that intersects with a rejection that we need to win, but that it's to be human means to stand up when it's not popular to do so. When the guy you may have voted for is in office is when your conscience is tested. It's easy to be a vegetarian between meals. It's easy to be against war when cartoonish villains like Bush and Cheney are there. Where the medal is tested, it's times like this. When your principles are tested, times like this. And it's why I'm so grateful for the work of groups like Kappa and for the commitment of all of you in the room tonight. And I thank you so much for your time and for being here.
Thank you so much. Stick around, we're keeping you up here for Q&A.
I mean, the question is, she was just talking about working with all, various groups like Common Cause and others, and that they're engaged in all of these struggles and on these issues, but that they can't get any media coverage. And then she made some reference to my age, which I'm not going to repeat. I hear you. You know, it's funny. I was just thinking when you were talking that. Amy Goodman, who now is like one of my nearest and dearest friends, I've probably heard her give 300 speeches, in every single one of those 300 speeches, she always says that we've reached an all new low with the state of media in this country. And she's right every time she says it, which is kind of funny because this spans now more than a decade of hearing her speak like regularly. We have a media culture in this country that is totally bankrupt. And what's incredible is that it used to be that there was a conspiracy where like the fat white guys with cigars would be in the back room, and some of them worked for big newspapers or television networks, and some of them were from the government, and they would be conspiring as to how to sort of shape and mold the message to present to the people. And then at some point, it became unnecessary to even have the individuals smoking their cigars in the back room because the infrastructure of these media outlets was so tailored to the interests of corporations that it became irrelevant. But you're asking a more nuanced question. Why don't they cover activist causes in media? Remember Ted Koppel when he, I think there's some good things to be said about Ted Koppel, and then there's some very critical things to be said about Ted Koppel, but for some of the younger people who might not know this, so Ted Koppel of ABC News had this show Nightline, and it was on network television in prime time. And for a while, it was every night during the hostage crisis in Iran. And Ted Koppel did something kind of extraordinary that hadn't really been seen since Edward R. Murrow, was considered to be sort of the trusted news person in an America that only had a handful of networks. And Nightline was covering this breaking news story every night from all sorts of angles. If you go back and watch the archival coverage of it, some of it was very much taking the American Empire line, but it largely was pretty extraordinary independent reporting about what the students were doing in Iran, about what U.S. policy had been, what led up to it. And after the hostage crisis was resolved, Nightline then became kind of an institution, and it became known as the one sort of serious television show that was on during prime time. The reason that Ted Koppel is no longer on television at Nightline is not just that he grew too old and couldn't do it. It's that advertisers started complaining to ABC News and saying, we don't want our product to be on during a story about, dead people or kids being killed or civilians being killed in war or about, some story about oil dictatorships in Africa. We don't want our product associated with those kinds of stories. And so eventually, then they tried to transition Nightline into a kind of pop thing that was going to cover Michael Jackson's demise as a public figure and, whatever the pop star of the day was doing. And eventually, it just fizzled out into nothing. And we live in a society right now where a tremendous amount of ad revenue can be generated by networks for doing what's called reality television programming, which is why we have a formula in this society that results in more people in our country keeping up with the Kardashians that are keeping up with our new war. I mean, that's really what we're looking at. So, you know, activist causes have never been a major, you know, subject for media organizations to cover. But the challenge has never been greater than it is today, which is why I think that what we're seeing with the discussion and debate around net neutrality is so important. Citizen journalism is going to become increasingly important in our society. Who has access to information on the web? Who has access to the web in general? Those are key and crucial issues. You can't force or shame most media outlets into covering it. But you can say, you know what? We're not even going to depend on you anymore. We're going to try to figure out our own way to get our message out with our own creativity and our own social media networks. But that's why the battle against these corporations that want the monopoly on access to the internet, speeds of the internet, what content you can access on the internet, those are incredibly crucial to activists no matter what your issue is. So I don't have a direct answer for you other than to say there's probably nothing you could do to pressure media outlets, existing media outlets, into covering you, but there's a lot you can do to try to be creative in getting your own message out, and it's why we have to add net neutrality to the battles that we're fighting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the question of was about the draft, and our friend was saying that you know, she has a lot of colleagues and friends who are saying that the way to sort of confront these wars would be to bring back the draft, and she referenced how she had lived through this and that it disturbs her, and then asked what I thought about it. I mean, you know, one of the members of Congress who has regularly tried to put forward legislation to bring back the draft is Representative Charlie Rangel, who represents what has historically been an almost entirely Black, Dominican, and Puerto Rican constituency in Harlem, New York, and parts of Washington Heights. And I've talked to Charlie Rangel about this, and it's not that Charlie Rangel wants a draft. He actually doesn't. But his point is that, you know, he has so many of his constituents, and by the way, I actually do think Charlie Rangel is a totally corrupt member of Congress, but that's a different different conversation. But on this, you know, on this issue, let's just pretend Charlie Rangel is something other than that, and he's actually representing people, which on this issue I think he is in his district. He was saying that, look, you know, we've got a disproportionate number of young Black and Latino men who are dying even in these wars. And it's not that they're being drafted, it's that they have the recruiters in their schools, and they're being told, like, this is the way you get out of it. You sign up here, we're going to pay for your college, you're going to learn leadership skills, you're going to learn technical skills, and life's going to be great, and you're going to be supporting this country. And that's a strong pitch for a lot of people, a lot of kids who don't see a lot of opportunity for them. And it's part of why the military does recruit in very poor or working class areas in these high schools, is because they feel like they have their best recruiting pool. So the point of the, I don't know any member of Congress that wants to bring back the draft because they want a draft. I think most of them are people that, for in one way or another, are sort of on the more progressive end of the Democratic Party, and they're thinking about sending a message, because with very few exceptions, the children of the elite are almost never put in a position where they're in combat in these wars, even if they did sign up for the U.S. military. So I am entirely opposed to a draft for a whole slew of reasons that I'm sure many of the people in this room could just recite for me. But I understand the motivation of it. In a way it's political theater, and I think it's not bad political theater. The danger would be if somehow it passed and we did have a draft, you know. But I don't think that's going to happen.
So how do you get people to get engaged?
Outside beyond that.
I need my answer to that.
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, I would imagine that most of the people that are advocating a draft for you don't actually want young people to be drafted. So, you know, that's a just on a moral level, you can't gamble with other people's lives, which is what a draft ultimately is. I mean, I think we can make an argument on a moral level. We can make an argument on a strategic level. We can make an argument on a financial level. There is no argument that supporters of these wars, I think, could win with all the facts on the table. On a moral level, the United States does not have the moral standing in the world to claim that it is the arbiter of what's right and wrong in any other country around the world because of its history. On a strategic level, you could make a nationalist American argument that sending our young people overseas to die in wars that are ultimately being authorized by people who have no personal risk involved with it. Their family members aren't going to fight it. They're not going to pay the price economically, because mostly it's working families and the poor that pay the price for these wars, and that it ultimately undermines our own national security by creating and generating and encouraging the very threat that we claim to be fighting. We are creating more new terrorists every day, or people that we're going to label terrorists every day, than we are actually killing legitimate threats to our society or our nation. I mean, there are more people killed in this country every year by bee stings than there are by acts of terrorism, and with the exception of Monsanto, no one's talking about killing all of the bees. So, but the final one then is just a purely financial argument. I know we had record numbers this week in the stock market and the Dow and all this that I never pay any attention to, but I see it in the newspapers, and I know people are saying, oh, this just proves President Obama is right and all that. How many trillions of dollars, I haven't talked to Joe Stiglitz lately, but how many trillions of dollars did we spend on this war? How is it that almost no one made the connection between what the corrupt banks, financial institutions, predatory lenders were doing, and the fact that we were running ourselves into total bankruptcy with these wars? We have spent ourselves into oblivion on wars that have resulted in increasing the threat we claim to be defeating. So if we had a sober debate in this country, it's not that nation states don't have a right to defend themselves. Of course they do. But what does that defense look like? But the other thing is, we're not engaged in defensive wars. We're engaged in what they call preemptive wars. And we're preempting threats that may not even exist, and in the process creating the threats that we claim to be preempting. So I believe that if the argument that many people in this room would probably make on a moral level primarily had a fair hearing with all the facts, I think we would win that debate. But we have it so ingrained into our heads right now. Particularly think of this generation that's grown up in the shadow of 9/11, and that's all they've known. You have it ingrained in your head that there are these dark terrorist forces around the world that are plotting to kill you, and be afraid of getting onto an airplane and take your shoes off, and your liquids need to be x-rayed, and people need to be pulled aside, and metal detectors in schools and all of this stuff. And it's not that there's not violence in schools. It's how do you reduce that violence? We often are reacting to incidents by overreacting and making policy that's not in line with the actual threat. If we were serious about stopping violence in our schools today, we would look at our gun laws in this country. And how, but the same is true of our foreign policy. If we were interested in stopping terrorism, we would look at our so-called counterterrorism policy, because it actually is encouraging it. I've been to Yemen multiple times. President Obama has never been to Yemen, and yet he's making decisions about who we're going to kill and who's going to be allowed to live in Yemen. I'm not saying that's a prerequisite to make a decision about what you're doing, but I think that the people advising Obama know almost nothing about many of the countries that they're advocating these violent policies against. And if they went there onto the ground and they dialogued with people, they would realize that we could drain the swamp of the motivation for terrorism in a lot of countries without firing a single bullet, and certainly without launching a single predator to fire a drone. Question was what could be done about Islamophobia on a small scale level? I think that part of what has happened post 9/11, it happened certainly to an extent prior to 9/11, but post 9/11, the U.S. has embraced the spirit, and it's both Democrats and Republicans, to be honest, has embraced the spirit that there is this lurking threat that disproportionately comes from within a particular religious group or ethnic group. And it's similar to the way that Japanese people were treated inside of the United States, or Japanese Americans were treated inside of the United States during World War II, where there were these internment camps. And instead of just placing people in large-scale internment camps, the U.S. government has authorized what is essentially or effectively a global stop-and-frisk program against people who are Muslims or Arabs or of Pakistani, Bangladeshi, other South Asian descent. And so we're trying to still sort of hold the moral high ground by saying, well, we're not going to just round people up and put them into camps based on their religion or their ethnic identity, but we've begun a systematic campaign of harassment. And I think that in a lot of public institutions, both local and state and federal, there is systematic racial profiling. There also is a media culture that you know, manifests itself in popular television shows like Homeland, that reinforce the idea that there somehow is a disproportionate embrace of terrorism within Islam versus other religions. Let me give you one concrete example. We obtained these classified documents about the U.S. government's watchlisting program. And one of the documents was a 166-page secret document that was the government's rule book for watchlisting people. And one of the things we learned because of a very brave whistleblower who gave this to us is that there are more than 1.2 million people on the watch list. There are over 700,000 people who have been designated through a secret process as known or suspected terrorists, and that a majority of those people have no known connection to an actual terrorist organization, and that you can be placed on a terrorist watch list for a single uncorroborated Facebook post or tweet or Instagram post, and that dead people can be placed onto the watch list based on their name. And it doesn't say, like, oh, mistaken identity. That someone who was the spouse of a dead, known, or suspected terrorist, and then they die, they can then be placed on the watch list with the theory that someone may try to use their name in the spirit of honoring a martyr. This is in our own government's literature, that you can put a dead person on a no-fly list. How that corpse gets on the plane, I have no idea, but they're not going to let it happen. But anyway, if you read all of that stuff, but what I wanted to say in response to what you're saying is this: the top five cities in the United States where the U.S. government has determined there are known or suspected terrorists are New York City, is number one. Okay, number three is Chicago, number four is Houston, number five is San Diego. Guess what number two is? Number two is a city in Michigan with a population of 96,000. What's the population of Chicago right now? All right, blah, 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 million. Okay, so it's millions. San Diego, Houston, New York, millions. These are four huge cities, all right? Dearborn, Michigan is the city, 96,000 people. Why do you think Dearborn is on that? Dearborn has the highest percentage of Muslim Americans of any city in the United States and the highest percentage of Arab Americans of any city in the United States. I think that almost every single male, adult male, in the city of Dearborn is probably on some U.S. government watch list. Now, you certainly must be saying, well, obviously Dearborn must have terrorist plots left and right, people that have gone to Somalia and Pakistan and other things. No, not a single case of anyone connected to Dearborn involved with terrorism, except one person. And who was that one person? There was a plot to blow up the largest mosque in the United States, which is in Dearborn, Michigan, which was plotted by a white Vietnam War vet. That is the only terror plot in the history of Dearborn, Michigan. And yet that city is the number two place. Why? It's because of Islamophobia. It's because of ethnic and religious targeting. And it's because of xenophobia. Muslims in this society have been put in a position where they are forced to explain and preemptively apologize for a religion that they may not even be an active participant in, that they grew up in a family where the grandfather was religious and no one else was after that. Until we address the fact that we are assigning not just a set of beliefs to people of a certain faith, but we are assuming that people of a certain ethnicity or an identity that we've almost made tantamount to an ethnicity, that they all agree with each other, nothing's going to change in our society. College campuses is where a lot of this is on the front lines, and there's a big battle over it. And that's why I think it's very unpopular, very important, particularly for non-Muslim students, to raise awareness about Islamophobia and also to confront professors in the classroom who engage in it. And whenever Homeland premieres, I can't believe that show is still on the air, to use that also as an opportunity to talk to people about how these stereotypes affect our society. I unfortunately have to stop right now, but I wanted to say that I will, if anybody has books, whether you brought them or you got them here, happy to sign them. Also happy if you want to come by and say hi or ask a question or make a comment. I'm happy to do that too, but my voice is about to pop and I have to give a talk tomorrow morning. So thank you all very much. I appreciate your time.